Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like mugs at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is episode 77 of the show and it is the 13th of September.
Friday the 13th?
Oh, it is too. Oh, very spooky. We have a lot of Friday the 13th.
Today's 14th.
Yeah, oh, it's the 14th. My bad. All right, 14th.
That's Nina, the ombudsman.
This is why you don't prepare the show on the 13th because you'll end up writing 13th.
Yep.
All right, so it's the 14th of September. Sorry for any interruptions and confusion. And we got a bumper show for you guys today. We are, so not us, but Gideon Rosner talked to Nigel Farage. Very short interview. Didn't have a whole lot of time, but 6 minutes of absolute gold from Nigel Farage and Gideon. Then we're going to have Gideon in the studio talking about how he got into a room with Nigel Farage for an interview with about, like, what, 1, maybe 2 hours notice? That's a lot of fun. Then we're going to be talking to Janet Olbrechtsen, IPA director and columnist at The Australian. We're going to be talking to her about a few of the issues that came up this week, such as, Pete, if I may lead off.
Hit it.
So the big story this week, international story, seemed to be Serena Williams at the US Open. So if you don't know the story, you've kind of been in and out. So basically, she's at the final of the US Open. She's up against this Japanese player,
Naomi Osaka,
which is part of the problem here that I don't know.
Yeah, that's part of the problem.
But she's losing. It should have been an easy win for her. She's losing badly. In the first set, she's warned by the chair umpire that she's getting coaching from the box. That's not allowed in tennis. The coaches aren't allowed to help you. So that's a warning. Then later, she breaks a racket. That's a 1 point deduction. Yep. And then the third point, this was the one that got international attention. The third violation where she's docked an entire game in the second set, the very decisive set, she would go on to lose. And she absolutely has a meltdown over this. Yep. She says to the chair umpire, "You will never, ever, ever be on another court of mine as long as you live. You are the liar. When are you going to give me my apology? You owe me an apology. Say it, say you're sorry, and say you stole a point from me. You're a thief too."
Well, me and James have those kind of discussions from time to time.
I mean, it's basically from the James Bond Peter Gregory playbook.
You are a thief. Anyway.
So that got international attention, whether or not tennis has a sexism problem, because, you know, in the follow-up to it, Serena Williams got in front of the media. She said, "I've seen men call umpires several things. I'm here fighting for women's rights and for women's equality and for all kinds of stuff." That's a direct quote, not me summarizing. "For me to say thief and for him to take a game, it made me feel like it was a sexist remark. He's never taken a game for a man because they said thief." Well, immediately my reaction would be, because I don't think a man's ever called him a thief. That's such a specific threat to a chair umpire. So what did you make of this all?
Well, I mean,
we are going to be talking about this with Janet a bit more in depth, but we'll get our own thoughts out.
So just quickly, it's sort of, for me, like, you know, who cares if the umpire's right or wrong? It's more everything is like sexism.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the first port of call when a man and woman have a dispute is, oh, this must be a gender thing.
Yeah, yeah.
When clearly a man and a woman can disagree pretty robustly, doesn't matter. Sexism. Second thing is, it's this assumption, because identity politics has these, you know, this ladder, if you will, of oppression where white men are at the top and then other groups are below it.
Yeah.
It shows you how stupid that is, because in this case, she's clearly more powerful than him.
Yeah.
No one's heard of this guy until last week. She's incredibly rich, powerful.
I still don't know what his name is.
Something Ramos.
Yeah, yeah.
Ramos. Anyway, so for me, it just threw up a few of the problems with identity politics.
Yeah, absolutely. And the second thing is, it got turned into a sexism issue. Where did this come from? There was one legitimate sexism storm at the US Open, which was a player in one of the first rounds. She's about to about to restart the match. I think it was halfway through or something. She realizes her top's on backwards.
Yeah.
So she quickly takes off her top, changes back to the front way forwards, puts it back on, and she's deducted a point. Now, you think of, like, how many times you're watching the US Open and the men just change shirt at the end of a rally. Like, that's just a thing that happens.
To me, that's
pure sexism. It's like, you know, she's fined a point for that.
I mean, remember when Pat Rafter used to take his top off at the Australian Open? That was a real highlight for a lot of the patrons in the stadium.
I'm sure it was. sorry, a bit before my time.
Yeah, the older patrons will know.
There's a lot of people nodding. I'll give you that. Then this one just seems to be like Serena Williams, you know, fiery competitor. I mean, probably the greatest women's tennis player of all time.
Yeah.
As many Grand Slam titles as she won. But she's got a bit of a history of this. She told a lineswoman one year that she would shove a ball down her throat because of a bad call. Like, she does
pretty full on.
Yeah, she can be full on. You need to be competitive to get to where she's got to.
Yeah, she's a great athlete.
Yeah, it's turned into a sexism thing, which I think is just more Serena Williams plays on the edge a little bit.
Yeah, it's sort of repackaging.
Yeah, and I say this in the interview with Jana, but the complaint of men are called fiery competitors and women are called emotional when this happens. Like, again, Nick Kyrgios has never been called a fiery competitor when he starts yelling at an umpire or yelling at his player's box. Like, Philippoussis as well. I don't think ever, like, fiery competitor was thrown at him.
Nah.
Yeah.
No, not Philippoussis. A few other accusations at Mark Philippoussis. What I also...
Case is still ongoing.
This is... Yeah, he's an interesting character. The other thing about this is, of course... we forget about the actual achievement of Osaka.
Yeah, that's the thing.
First Japanese woman to win the US Open. First Japanese person, yeah. Right? We talk about a woman outperforming men. No Japanese man's ever won a Grand Slam.
Yeah, Nishikori came close a few times, but never won it.
Yep. Well, you know, that's tennis. And we've completely forgotten about that.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Like, she's in tears in the ceremony.
Yeah, just, she feels like ashamed of her achievement, which is you know, unfortunate.
It is. So, yeah, again, we're going to be talking to Janet Albrechtsen a bit more about that. Move on to another story, Pete.
Okay, look, let's go with the other one in Australia, which has emerged in the last couple of days. A 9-year-old girl in Queensland refused to stand for the national anthem. This caused a bit of a stir around the country. So the national anthem at her primary school. She got a lunchtime detention, which is, you know, that's pretty big when you're nine, not being able to go out for lunch. So obviously this has created a bit of a storm. I think me and you both agree, James, that it's a bit of an indictment on our culture that we're taking our cues from a 9-year-old.
Yeah, well, it's just like... If a 9-year-old wants to kneel for an anthem, like, you know, okay. Like, yeah. The 9-year-old standing for something. But, like, you know, I don't want to kneel for the anthem or anything. But because it's come at the same time that Nike does a Colin Kaepernick campaign, it becomes an international story.
Yeah, of course. Oh, has this gone international?
Yeah, it has. So news agencies in the UK, US, including BBC and CNN have all covered this.
Yeah, okay.
And so I'm just thinking, like, you know, hang your heads in shame. You're making the 9-year-old girl this famous. You know how terrible the internet is. I don't want to alarm any listeners out there, but there can be negative comments.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what if this 9-year-old one day just, like, Googles her own name and just sees what people have been writing about it?
Oh, I
just think, like, one 9-year-old in one classroom in Brisbane one time does not deserve to be an international story.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree. And I think... it'll probably go on because she's like, I'm not going to do it next week either. Yeah.
Well, she was on the project with her dad. She? Like, what is that? Yeah. Like, you've got the face and the name as well. Like, how famous do you want to make a 9-year-old girl? This is very disturbing to me.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, you know, her parents obviously are happy with it, so I guess...
Well, the dad was next to her, so yeah.
I would say, like, obviously you don't want to go too harsh on a 9-year-old girl, but one of the issues that I have with this idea, she's saying, you know, the national anthem is for white people. Mm. You know, so what about all the white people, non-white people in Australia who are actually like, well, I'm quite proud to be Australian.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Are you saying this institution's not for me?
Mm.
Once again, it's a problem with identity politics is that it thinks every people in a certain group think the same way.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to give you lip on this one.
That's right.
I think the problem with this story is that Peter Gregory was just correcting a 9-year-old girl's opinion. Like, what's happening to the world where Peter Gregory has to go toe-to-toe with an ideological... a 9-year-old.
I don't like my chances, but you know. But the thing is,
that's why I'm trying to protect you.
Lots of people who aren't 9 think that as well.
Yeah, that's the thing. So yeah, well, again, that's another one we're going to be talking to with Janet a bit later in the show. One thing we won't be talking about with Janet, so we can go pretty in depth with, is the South Yorkshire Police.
Oh,
now
the SYP,
Britain. They're gone. Like that's Britain's done.
British police are cooked.
Yeah,
they just voted for Brexit.
Yeah. So the story is, South Yorkshire Police sent out a tweet this week. I'll read it in full. In addition to reporting hate crime, please report non-hate crime incidents, which can include things like offensive or insulting comments online, in person, or in writing. Hate will not be tolerated in South Yorkshire. Report it and put a stop to it. Hashtag hate hurts SY.
That is amazing.
Please report non-crime hate incidents. Like, you thought crime was bad, try thought non-crime.
It's amazing on so many levels.
Yeah.
Like as if we haven't got enough crimes to follow up on, send in stuff that isn't crime.
Well, see, that's the point. So South Yorkshire is one of the places where, you know, the rape gangs were happening and police weren't looking at it. So the idea that the police, you know, the police aren't following up on crimes that are reported, like actual crimes. Like, how are they going to follow up with... They're now volunteering themselves to follow up on non-crimes.
And that radio interview that you linked to in Hey, What Did I Miss?
Yeah, so that's the Chief Commissioner of the South Yorkshire Police defending the tweet on radio.
Yep, and that what's that lady's name? She the interviewer, she's
I never
harsh.
Quite got her name, but
Talk
yeah,
radio.
So...
UK, check it out.
Yeah, UK Talk Radio and...
And the snivelling responses, like, well, sometimes in communities... people are mean to each other.
Yeah.
And that causes crime. Like, is that not the biggest victim shaming thing of all time?
It's massively victim shaming. He also says at one point, it can feel like crime. And I would say, do you know what else feels like crime? Actual crime.
Yeah.
Usually feels like crime.
It's so bad. Like, yeah. That is just dead set victim shaming.
Yeah.
And gee, haven't the South Yorkshire police come a long way since the Hillsborough disaster?
Yeah, that was another thing that got brought up.
the biggest cover up in post-war British history until probably Rotherham. So
yep.
Two in a row for them.
So yeah, it's just the thing of, you know, how on the decline is free speech in the UK?
Oh, yeah,
even like, you know, okay, we might not be able to make this a crime, but we can make it a non-crime, and we'll still get a call from the police for it.
And them shopping around for crime.
Yeah, the hunting for complaints is very chilling, and I don't like it. Okay, so Pete,
yeah,
another Google story we're going to be talking about, Google.
This story should be bigger than it is.
Yeah,
Google are crooks.
Yeah.
They are a pack of crooks.
Well, not actual crooks. Moral crooks, maybe.
So last week it's emerged. Yeah, yeah. They're not actual crooks. Yeah. Good for the lawyers. Well, the lawyers are happy with that one.
I'm sure they're still a bit miffed. But
yeah. So Google ads for a Russian dissident were removed from YouTube, I believe.
Yeah. Which Google owns.
Which is owned by Google. At the request of the Russian government.
Yeah.
Right? So they said, oh, you know, it's the lead up to this regional election. In Russia, they have these rules that you can't advertise for elections within 24 hours or something.
Yeah.
This guy wasn't talking about the elections.
I think there's like a hidden bylaw, which is you can't also have campaigns against Putin in the lead up to an election.
Really?
No.
like
basically.
I was like, yeah, exactly.
If it was like a pro-Putin campaign, I don't think the Russian government's like, can you guys shut this down right now?
That was very good deadpan.
Thank you.
I was taken in by that. But no,
never believe anything I say.
Well, see, I normally apply that.
I like you, Pete.
anyway... Look, this is so much worse than Google just doing stupid lefty causes. Yeah. Like, how many dictators are they enabling around the world?
Yeah.
Look, they should not be let off the hook for this.
No, they shouldn't.
They are enabling Vladimir Putin, who kills journos that he doesn't like.
Yeah, so Moscow previously warned Google of possible prosecution if it didn't remove the video, so Google capitulates.
Oh, yeah.
But if I can take us back to about 3 weeks ago, when Google was one of the social media giants that took a brave stand against Alex Jones and what he's doing to democracy and what he's doing to civility.
Yeah, exactly, of course.
But if it's a Russian government and they might fight back and sue us and be mean to us, we're scared of them.
Like, as if Google can't win a legal battle with the Russian government. Anyway, But what's the other thing? They censor PragerU videos. You know, these videos about mainstream conservative ideas.
Okay, cool. So we'll just wrap up a few. This will be a bit of a monologue for me because we've got a few events that we need to run through.
I'm happy to take a break.
Yeah. So they just
always happy to take a break.
Put your feet up. Open up a can of Coke. And if you have anything to chime in with, let me know. So Matthew Lesh, one of our research fellows here, friend of the show. You guys would have heard and enjoyed a lot of his interviews here. So he is about to release his first book later this month, Democracy in a Divided Australia, through Conacourt Publishing. You can pre-order it now on the Conacourt website. And I think we've also linked to it on our Facebook account, so make sure you're going through there.
I read the foreword. I haven't read the book, but I read the foreword written by John Roskam.
Yep.
And it seems like it's going to be a cracker.
Yes. And I've read the blurb, and there was a lot of very supportive things to say from Janet Albrechtson and Senator James Patterson. So,
excellent. And it's going to be opened by Amanda. You might be saying
Amanda Stoker. Yeah, I'm going to get to that. So it's Democracy in a Divided Australia. It's an analysis of the growing tribalism of Australian politics and the capture of policymaking by a new elite and how we can get it back. So there's going to be a launch event for our listeners in Queensland. It's going to be in Brisbane on the 27th of September. Senator Amanda Stoker is going to be saying a few words at the event, and it's going to be hosted by our friends at Conacourt Publishing. So go to Conacourt, pre-order the book, grab yourself a ticket to that event. Don't miss out. It's going to be a lot of fun. And then another event we're going to plug. So our friends at the Australian Taxpayers Alliance, Tim Andrews runs it. He's a friend of the show as well. They're going to be hosting the second Ray Evans Memorial Oration on October 12 in Melbourne. Ray Evans, really great guy, so we miss him dearly. So make sure you're going down to that event if you're in Victoria. The oration is going to be delivered by Andrew Bolt, another friend of the show.
Is that Sting? You didn't get the call up?
You know, I'll say a few words. I'll do the forward to the speech.
Okay.
A lot of forwards happening. So make sure you're going to the Australian Taxpayers Alliance website and you can register when you're there. So now, the interviews that we've got to go to. So we're going to go to Nigel Farage, then we're going to go to Gideon, and then we're going to be talking Serena and the kneeling 9-year-old with Janet Albrechtson. But before we go to all of those, guys, thank you so much for listening to the show. Thank you so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes, Podbean, and Spotify, but you can download us through all the other apps like Pocket Cast and stuff like that.
Cool.
So make sure you're doing it through that. Make sure you're also telling your friends and family about the show. Maybe they want to listen. Maybe they want to subscribe as well. And if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you're leaving us a 5-star review. It's really simple in your iOS operating system. All you need to do is just scroll down on our podcast page on your phone. You can leave us a 5-star review, maybe a comment, tip for the show. And yeah, that's all I got. So Nina, pressing the buttons for us as always, doing a great job of it. If people want to become a financial member of the IPA, or maybe they're already members and they want to donate some cold, hard cash to the IPA, how can they go about doing that?
Or just visit the websites at ipa.org.au, and if you want to donate, just click on the donation button. If you want to join or you want to refer someone to join the membership as a member, just click on the join button. And as low as $22 per year, you can become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
That's good to me. So let's go to those interviews now.
Mr. Farris, thank you so much for joining us after your sellout show here in Sydney. I think that was more high octane than most rock concerts I've seen lately. And what I saw was not hateful, it wasn't racist, it wasn't bigoted or anything the left will have you see. What I saw tonight was a celebration or an advocacy of small government and sovereignty and devolution of power.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, look, I just think we've lost our way. Mm. You know, I was a businessman. I got into politics because I just thought that our career politicians, and I emphasise that word very strongly, acting at the behest of giant multinationals, had lost any sense of their values. You know, people want to live in nation states. And underpinning that is our Judeo-Christian culture. Mm. That is what our entire massively successful civilization is based on. And I see people selling that out for their own short-term personal gain. And I think, do you know what? The hell with it. I'm going to fight back against it. And that's what I've been doing. But you're right. I mean, the idea that I'm some extremist radical, all I'm saying is I think we should govern our own countries, live in nation states, be proud of our identity, defend our heritage. I mean, how am I some sort of, you know, ridiculous revolutionary character?
Well, what about the P word, populism? I mean, it's bandied around by the left. Is it a badge of honour? Is it something that we need to rail against?
Well, whether it's populist or not, I don't know. But I tell you what, it's very popular. I think that's what really matters.
I think you personally...
And that's what people are voting for. And look, also, come on. Politics has become so dreary, so dull. I mean, the people are so appalling. And I go into this, and you've just been with me in that room there. I don't try and pretend to be anything different to what I am. Mm. I'm a human being. I've got my flaws. I laugh and joke.
And you own them.
And I, absolutely. Well, because what that means is they can't really attack me for it. come on. Do you know, I'll tell you something. One of the most powerful things is humour.
Mm.
If we can use humour.
Ridicule.
If we can mock them. If we can satirise them. Goodness me, there are loads of easy targets. And that is what I try to do. It's a serious message, but it's delivered to people in a way that I hope is entertaining and fun as well.
I think it was certainly entertaining and fun tonight. One thing you mentioned, which I was very interested in, is that if political parties in Australia, particularly the Liberal Party, didn't get their act together and better reflect their constituencies, something radical could very well happen here.
Yes.
What did you mean by that?
We are seeing across much of the world a reordering of our politics. There are not many commonalities because they vary. In Britain, it was Brexit. Basically, a country turning around its direction. In America, it was Donald Trump completely hijacking the Republican Party. I mean, doing it in the most remarkable way through the people's revolt. Well, through the open primary system. I mean, that's how he did it, basically. And in Italy, two new parties, one on the right, one on the left, suddenly emerge, and they've got a good majority in government. So the modus operandi varies from place to place, but if anybody thinks that Australian politics is set in stone and it's never going to change, wake up and smell the coffee.
What do you make of this idea that politicians should aspire to be in the so-called sensible centre? Is that a myth? Does it exist? Should we stand by our beliefs?
Well, I think that's what's been happening. I think there's been a drive over decades towards us all becoming social democrats, basically, where nobody really believes in anything. But I remember going back to 2012, looking at the American presidential election, looking at the two candidates and thinking, what are the fundamental ideological differences between these two? I couldn't find them. Mm. And we had the same when, at the end of Tony Blair in Britain, Cameron took over the Conservative Party and called himself in private the heir to Blair. I mean, they're always going to mimic each other. Real people have hearts and minds. They have passions. They have beliefs. Politics should be about a battle for the direction that countries go.
The battle of ideas.
Absolutely. And that's what invigorates us as human beings. It's why democracy is so much more infinitely preferable to any other form of government. All these so-called centrists, all they really want to do is to give away the decision-making abilities to some sort of form of higher global order, and they can go to their smart dinner parties and virtue signal to all their mates. It's all a lot of old rubbish.
Fantastic. And finally, for us in Australia, a world away from Europe, a world away from the EU, what's the number one lesson we can learn, the right in Australia, about what's the lesson we can learn from Brexit and the success of Brexit, despite the fact the establishment was so vehemently against it?
Get the arguments over immigration right. Make sure you are not tagged in with an extremist fringe that want to go to war against an entire religion of Islam, that want to basically demonise anybody with different coloured skin. Mm. You can play that game if you want to, you'll lose.
Yep.
It ain't going nowhere. You know what? Understand. And we talk about Middle England, we talk about the flyover states in America. Understand where average, ordinary Australians are. They want... Look, this is a fantastic country.
Mm.
Don't muck it up.
We'll try not to. Mr. Farage, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, so we've just heard Gideon Rosner talk with Nigel Farage.
Yes.
Sorry, short, sharp, but very good. So Gideon, in the studio with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, so here to reflect on what the interview was about, how you guys got there. So first off, how did we get the interview with Farage?
So it came about as this happenstance thing. It was the most amazing thing. So as a lot of you know, I've been on the road, and as well as Stuart Eaton and a few others, with Alfredo Ortiz from the Job Creators Network, who's a hell of a guy, one of them, you know, really sort of softly spoken, but charismatic, smart, and really approachable blokes you'll meet, and very unassuming. So we were having bus issues, and Henry Travers and I and Alfredo were in a renter car sort of travelling down towards Sydney from Port Macquarie. And Alfredo's sort of sitting in the front playing with his phone. And we were going to go to Farage that night anyway. We'd bought tickets. So Alfredo's tapping away with his phone in the front seat and sort of suddenly says, oh, I think I could get us a meeting with Farage tonight. I know his guy, his agent. And I'm like, oh, you could? That'd be nice. I sort of said, can you get us an interview as well?
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, sure. Let me see what I can do. So he taps away. And, you know, 45 minutes later, we get this interview. And it was the most, you know... It was basically us and 2GB and Andrew Bolt who got interviews.
There's three main media organisations in Australia.
Well, they're really the big boys.
2GB, Sky News, and the Young RPA podcast. I mean, you know, it's a big league sort of thing. So anyway, so I get Henry to bloody gun the car so we get to the venue on time and all the rest, and we need he needed to teach me how to use the podcasting equipment and everything else. So we. We go in, and the plan was to barrel up Farage at the pre-function, because there was a dinner for about $1,000 a head for VIPs beforehand. We didn't have tickets to it, but Alfredo was sort of said, okay, you know, we'll just work our way in. It's fine. And anyway, so we have to duck and weave through. I've seen less security for the PM than I've seen for Farage. There were goons everywhere, and we had to sort of duck and weave past the security and everything else. But eventually we got in, and
he definitely knew that you were being... Like, you were going to interview him. Because when Pete and I were interviewing Douglas Murray, when we got there, we sort of thought, are we sure he knows about this? Like, there was so much confusion
about it. Oh, no, he
didn't know. Oh, so he definitely didn't know.
His agent knew. But his agent was doing a solid for Alfredo anyway. So we couldn't quite catch him at the pre-function. And me and Stu, Alfredo just sort of blended in and went to the function anyway. But me and Stu, we were sort of hanging around like groupies or like, you know, sad fans. So in the end, it got a bit pathetic. So we sort of went to a bar and regrouped. Anyway, we went to the show,
And then afterwards, we hung around backstage, and it was a weird event because Farage was being brought out by Penthouse magazine.
Okay.
And there were all manner of, you know, people from Penthouse. There were blockchain enthusiasts. There were sort of all different elements of the sort of libertarian underworld gathering there.
You're all people, Gideon.
Yeah, well, correct. My kind of folk. Anyway, so I set up the podcasting equipment, and Alfredo just gently guided Farage to the table, and he sat down. And I have to say, for some podcast that he'd never heard of, a young bloke like me with a little dinky microphone, he was as on and as attentive and as generous with his time as he would be for CNN. I mean, he was a true professional, and he'd just done, you know, 2 hours of an extremely high-octane performance. So we're very, very lucky to have it. Credit goes to our great friend Alfredo, whose networks go very far and wide, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a fantastic night. I mean, the energy in the room was unlike anything I've seen. I mean, there were 300-odd people there packed in, people who, by the way, had to line up for, you know, half an hour to get patted down by security. There were cops with armour there, protesters turning up. I mean, it's amazing that to hear, you know, a mild-mannered British politician, you have to go through this obscene security. But the crowd, that said, they weren't all deplorables. There were a few Make America Great Again hats. There were a few people with T-shirts saying, you know, proud conservative and all sorts of other things. But most of the crowd were ordinary looking people. It was mixed. It was all ages. It was both genders. You know, really people who were there to hear a new idea and who, you know, some of whom you get the impression that they were actively, you know, they might not have agreed with the whole message, but they were actively attempting to cross a picket line to hear ideas. That's the world we live in.
Mm-hmm.
There is a subversiveness now in having to go through such security to hear a different point of view, but there was a sort of unspoken...
But Gideon, Trump is destroying open debate.
Well, yeah, that's correct.
Trump is destroying it.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't get distracted by all the security you had to go through. Trump is destroying open debate.
Well, free speech leads to hate speech, which leads to violence. So, but no, it was just a fantastic night. And Farage was excellent. He is a terrific showman. And I think what you've just heard, and the most interesting part of his speech was, you know, he gets written off as this terrible racist and race baiter and all the rest. The end of the interview, I was fascinated. He said to me, you know, I said, what's the one piece of advice you can offer, you know, the Australian right, those of us who are, you know, basically fellow travellers? And he said, don't get bogged down in a holy war with Islam. There are going to be all manner of lunatics will come forward and try to jump on the bandwagon and try to make this about some sort of issue that it's not. You know, if we go to war with an entire religion and we go for this fringe racist rubbish, then we are going to lose. Stick to the issues. Stick to the matter of sovereignty and small government and self-determination and the values we believe in, and we will win the day because our arguments are better. So I couldn't be more impressed with Farage. I was sort of an admirer of his, but I didn't know too much about what he was on about before, but I was absolutely spellbound like 299 other people that night.
Absolutely.
Now, tell me that you boozed on a bit with Nigel.
Yeah, so I did.
And that was the real interview part.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at the photo that I put on Facebook, I had a beer and he had a red wine. The guy's he's my kind of fella because he sort of got up and he said, look, I'm not a racist. I married a German, you know, and I've drank more Spanish red than any person alive. I mean, the guy is, you know, he owns it. He is who he is. There was a video of him having a cigarette. You know, he had a glass of wine. He had a glass of wine when he was talking to me. You know, he's an old-fashioned sort of no-nonsense bloke. You know, he is who he is. And I think that's one of the things people respect about Farage, that he has a rare quality, which is authenticity. He's somebody who says exactly what he means. He calls it as he said, and he won. He marshalled 52% of the country against the establishment.
Absolutely. So we talked briefly about the tour that you're on with Alfredo. Do you want to talk more about that? So Alfredo is from the Job Creators Network in the US, and it was sort of like a return trip for what you did in Iowa, which we were talking about with you on the podcast before.
Yeah, so the Job Creators Network is this fantastic organization that has built the case for, built the case for, among other things, the Trump company tax cuts, which have led to the revival of the economy in the US. What they do is very different from what normal chambers of commerce do, which is here and in the US, which is run dry economic arguments, which is, you know, GDP growth will result from tax cuts and so on. They go from town to town speaking to real people who've gone through trials and tribulations, put everything on the line for their business and have sacrificed a lot. And, you know, people at the rally I went to in Iowa who have been sleeping on the floor of their conference room at their factory for 2 years and not taking a salary. So we decided to bring Alfredo out to Australia. We got a bus for the first time, and not something the IPA usually does. We had IPA branding and Job Creators Network branding on the side of it. Mm. And we drove from Brisbane to Ballina to Lismore to Sydney to Newcastle to Canberra. We spoke to, you know, ordinary small business owners and ordinary people who saw the bus and saw the message and said, finally, somebody is out there fighting for us. There is we hear so much about, from the unions, about, you know, workers and their issues, but nobody talks about the issues that we have really trying to create jobs and trying to employ people and trying to run a small business. So that was fantastic. We ended up in Canberra. We had some great meetings with some politicians. I think there's an awareness that we have to do better than just, you know, going out to Queanbeyan on a sitting day, putting on a high-vis vest and having some poor schmo who happens to own the warehouse nod in the background. We have to hear from real people. Just saying things like jobs and growth over and over again will not cut it anymore.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Cool. So if you guys want to learn a bit more about what Alfredo was doing in Australia, there's an interview of John Roscombe, our executive director, sitting down with Alfredo. That's on our YouTube channel and our Facebook page. Yeah. Gideon, thanks so much for joining us.
Cheers. Thanks, guys.
Okay, we now welcome back to the show IPA director and columnist at the Australian, Janet Olbrechtsen. Welcome back.
Hi, James.
All right, so let's talk about it. Goes, the big story this week was Serena Williams' meltdown at the US Open. There was this whole issue of whether or not this is an example of sexism in tennis and whether the chair umpire was a sexist himself. So what did you make of that whole story?
Well, when I looked at the... Let's start with the hissy fit on court. I thought that it was a hissy fit. I didn't think it was too hard to interpret. I looked at that, her pointing the finger, her telling the umpire that he was never going to work again, threatening him, calling him a liar and a thief. I thought she got what she deserved.
Yeah,
I didn't think that was sexist. I didn't think it was racist. I thought she was a bad loser overshadowing her opponent, and I thought it was really, really sad to see that the woman who won was completely overshadowed.
That's right. She was, like, genuinely upset. And the thing about it is, like, this is an actual massive achievement. Like, we're going to talk about gender equality. This is a massive achievement for a woman, first person from Japan to win a Grand Slam. And it gets overshadowed by her behaviour.
Yeah, someone who idolised Serena Williams growing up said, all I want to do is take her on in a final, and then that's what happens when it happens.
And played really well.
Yeah, and look, Serena Williams has done this before when she's, you know, when she's been on a bit of a losing streak. She strikes out. She is a terrific athlete. I love her, we know, when she's at her best. But that was definitely Serena Williams at her worst. So, you know, spare me the accusations of sexism and racism. And by the way, does she have to scream out about being a mother and doing it for a daughter? Doing what for a daughter? Behaving like a brat on court?
Exactly.
I thought that was awful.
Yeah, the other part of that sexism thing that was getting tossed around was the idea that, oh, when women do this on a tennis court, they're called emotional, but when men do it, they're called fiery competitors. Which strikes me as weird because I've never heard Nick Kyrgios described as a fiery competitor when he has a meltdown on court.
I wish he was more competitive sometimes.
Yeah, like when he breaks a racket, everyone's like, what a guy.
I've heard him be described as a brat.
Mm.
So, you know, is there something sexist about that? No, I just think people are looking to cry about being a victim whenever things aren't going their way. And this was a classic case of Serena Williams just being a really, really bad loser. We've seen a lot of them in politics in recent weeks, and I just thought this was a bad loser on the tennis court.
I think what this does also is brings into sharp relief one of the problems with identity politics is that it ranks groups according to their power, right? And according to that ranking, this guy is meant to be more powerful than Serena Williams. But clearly Serena Williams is more powerful than him. Like, she's a millionaire, she's really famous, she's really influential. No one had heard of this guy until last week. So that was a big takeout for me.
You're so right, Pete. I mean, it just turns power politics on its head, doesn't it? I can't remember his name, but I know Serena Williams' name. I suspect her purchasing power, her earning capacity, is somewhat greater than his. So, but you're not allowed to point out those kinds of realities, because identity politics has a fast rule about who has power, and anything that challenges that is just ignored.
Yeah,
you've got to stick to the old historical power play between blacks and whites and women and men, and we're not allowed to actually acknowledge that that has changed.
Absolutely. So the other part of that happens. So Mark Knight makes a cartoon about it, I think the next day or the day after, making fun of Serena Williams, and that just went international. Like, J.K. Rowling got involved. I think CNN got involved. It was trending on Twitter from a lot of the US accounts that I follow. And then this became this whole thing, like, is Mark Knight a racist? And he's forced, like, well, not forced, but he chose to delete his Twitter account. What did you make of that angle of it?
Well, you can't win, can you, if you're a white man? Boy, would it have been okay if that had been drawn by a black woman, I wonder? I know that's a hypothetical question. But the fact that it was drawn by a white man who drew a large-framed female tennis player with frizzy hair and big lips who wears cutesy tennis outfits having a tantrum on court, overshadowing her opponent and bullying the umpire, I think that's what I saw when I was watching tennis that night. That's Serena Williams. Is she meant to be portrayed as a small woman with straight hair, thin lips, in some sort of conservative little white tennis outfit? That's not Serena Williams. He drew Serena Williams so we could recognise her. He did it brilliantly. It was a funny cartoon. And then he was mobbed because he dared to mock a black female. He was labelled racist and sexist. Gosh, we've been here before, haven't we? We have been here before. The same thing happened with Bill Leake. This is Bill Leake gone global.
That's true. That's true. I hadn't actually thought of that that link. The other thing about this thing for me was that we were so quick to call this sexism. A man and a woman can have like a massive disagreement and it actually have nothing to do with gender.
Yeah, but this is the power and the breadth and depth of identity politics, that they cannot look at a cartoon without slicing and dicing it according to race, sexism, sexuality. I mean, it's lucky that Serena is not a lesbian, because poor Mark Knight would have been called homophobic too. So they will slice and dice it according to every group identity. It becomes a ticker box episode. How many labels can we throw at someone using all of these group identities? I look at a cartoon and I see whether it's funny or not. That's how I judge a cartoon.
The other thing,
I'm not looking at the colour of someone's skin. I'm not looking at whether it's a man who's drawn a picture of a woman.
Yeah, the other thing about the Mark Knight controversy was, aren't we only a few years removed from all these European leaders marching through the streets of Paris to defend the right of a cartoonist to make fun of whatever they think of? Like, have we already changed our minds on that issue, or is this just a completely new one?
Yeah, the problem is that, I remember Angela Merkel being there, at the front of that pack, Je suis Charlie, right? She wasn't so much in favour of free speech when people were out marching, raising questions about immigration. She literally wanted the lights turned out on those protesters. So I think that was just a shallow... Yeah, I'm very suspicious of anything that has a hashtag in front of it. It just strikes me, it's like wearing a little rubber band around your wrist or, a little ribbon on your lapel. This is not serious, but the one thing that is serious about social media is that it has become an absolute mob mentality. It's not about debate anymore. It's sort of one-line epithets that you throw at people. You're not actually discussing an issue. I mean, you can critique that cartoon all you like, but just to start throwing labels about Mark Knight being a racist or a sexist, that's just aimed at shutting him down. That is not a good sign. I mean, I just see all of these episodes, Pete and James, as, if you add them all up, you can't just sort of wipe them away and say, oh, this is crazy nonsense. You actually have to start recording them. Because once you start recording them, you see that I think we are on a knife edge in terms of, are we going to go forward with this sort of liberal democratic project, or are we going backwards? That's my fear.
Well, Janet, we saw in the last couple of days an issue here in Australia, and once it happened, it sort of struck me that it's strange this hasn't happened earlier. We saw a primary school student in Brisbane refuse to stand for the national anthem because, to paraphrase her, it's only for white people. What's your take on that?
I wasn't really upset by that. I think Pauline Hanson, you know, she said she was very angry when she saw this. It's almost like our default position is now outrage.
That's right. I agree.
It's the equal and opposite, although not so equal, because it's one person, Pauline Hanson, maybe a few others. So it's not quite equal, but it is the opposite reaction to the left's outrage. I mean, we are in an age of outrage, left and right. We're all shouting at each other. Pauline Hanson wants this young girl pulled out of school. I mean, come on. I think more reason to keep her in school. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, it does seem that the new right-wing outrage mob just to combat the left one. I just did have a follow-up question with that. So it's quite similar to the Colin Kaepernick thing of kneeling for the U.S. national anthem. So why do you think this 9-year-old girl isn't a quarterback in the NFL? Do you reckon the owners are colluding to keep her out of the league?
Can you do that in netball? Does it work in netball? Yeah, I don't know. It's just it's interesting though, isn't it? Because Nike have really picked that up as their branding issue, and you know, sort of as a different point. I think it's evidence that values matter. I mean, I don't particularly agree with the value that Nike has picked up by using that quarterback in their new ad. But it shows that values do matter. And I fear that, you know, on the centre-right of politics, we're not so good at actually defending values. And you can pick any episode in the last, you know, gosh, few years. More than ever, we should be defending values like freedom of expression.
Yeah, exactly. Like a Mark Knight cartoon, for instance.
Or a young girl who doesn't want to stand for the flag.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm okay with her. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, the other part of it for me is like, you know, maybe she arrived at this conclusion by herself, but I kind of feel like her parents might have pushed her around with that. But there does seem to be this like sort of bubble in Twitter at the moment of adults talking about what their children are doing as if the children have arrived that, and then that's just going to go viral. Like, I'll see a bunch of tweets like, oh, my 8-year-old came up to me in tears thinking that Hillary Clinton had lost the election, but then she, you know, wiped away her tears and said, maybe one day we'll get a US president who's a woman. So, like, why? How come there's this thing going around where the second a political point is made by someone under the age of 9, suddenly it becomes something really worth discussing and debating?
Well, you know, sometimes out of the mouth of babes come truths. But look, whether or not that young girl was being influenced by her parents, isn't that the role of parents? You know, like I would hope that my values are passed on to my kids. They might happen to be different to that girl's parents' values, but that's what parents are meant to do. You know, we can't enforce a set of values. We can only encourage them and defend them and hope that people understand that there are a set of values in Australia, whether it's standing up for the flag or whether you believe in free speech, that we should actually defend.
Absolutely. Janet, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Pleasure. Thanks, James. Thanks, Pete.
Okay.
What was that?
Should we leave that in? I want to leave it in.
If you want. That's just me uncut.
All right, anyway. That was the interviews with Nigel Farage, Gideon Rosner, and Janet Olbrechtsen. So thank you to those people for really interesting chats. So let's fly through some stories that made us laugh this week. This one was quite the Twitter thread, to be honest.
Mm. Oh,
so
this one, yeah.
I do love a good Twitter thread because they're never as important as the authors want them to be. So this story comes out of Goldsmiths University. It's a trans rights campaigning group.
Goldsmiths, is that in the UK?
It is in the UK. Good save, Pete. And they were talking about gulags. Gulags came up on Twitter, and they wanted to get a few things right.
What a place to unpack gulags.
Yeah.
The Twitter.
Yes, the brilliant discussion portal that is Twitter. That's where you really want to get into the science of gulags. So I'll read most of these tweets out because they're just incredible. And it is this week's Q&A clap of the week. So for new listeners to the show, we haven't done this one for a while, but when Pete and I watch Q&A on the very rare occasions that we do, we do get a bit jealous that... When Simon's on, or John, or you know, any staff member of ours, Nina's banned from the ABC after the last incident.
I know,
and I'm still waiting for that apology. But anyway, so Q&A, like you'll have these people just say these, you know, knee-jerk left-wing, unthought through opinions, and then the Q&A audience will just go wild for him. They'll give him a huge round of applause. Yeah. And Pete and I have enough knee-jerk opinions of our own that never get applauded by anyone.
Yeah.
I would say derided, mostly.
We just want to be liked.
Yeah. Oh, wouldn't that be something? Mm. We do get a bit jealous. So when we see something like this, we give them a Q&A clap, because if it was on a Q&A, I think it would get a round of applause. And then we give ourselves a Q&A clap because we don't like getting left out. This week's Q&A clap. So LGBTQ plus Goldsmiths. Here's a mini thread to clarify what a gulag is. For those who have only heard it used as a buzzword, and why sending a bigot to one is actually a compassionate, non-violent course of action.
Buzzword. Gulag's a buzzword.
Gulag is a buzzword. Because it's a buzzword, because when you hear it, you know you're about to die.
Soviet dissidents disagree.
Yeah. If they were still alive, they would disagree. Gulags. First myth to debunk. You work until you die in the gulags. The Soviets did away with life sentences, and the longest sentence was 10 years. Capital punishment was reserved for the most heinous, serious crimes. Why? The penal system was a rehabilitatory one. And self-supporting. A far cry from the Western capitalist notion of prison. The aim was to correct and change the ways of criminals. If it couldn't be done in 10 years, it couldn't be done at all.
Well,
went on to say something like...
Which is a bit menacing in itself.
Yeah, it's terrifying. They went on to describe the gulags as like benign places where inmates received education, training, and enjoyed the opportunity to take part in clubs, sports, and theatre groups. And if you worked your way up, it would have gone a bit better for you.
It actually sounds pretty enticing.
It sounds like a nice little holiday for you.
Bit of time out.
Yeah, bit of time away from the city. Time away from the stresses from the grind of being a dissident in Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just need to take a holiday for you.
Yeah.
There's so many things to come out of this. So we'll give him a Q&A clap first.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
But let's get into this, because this is just how ahistorical the left are becoming. Mm. Like, gulags being a summer camp thing.
Yeah.
Like, my first reaction is LGBTIQ plus at Goldsmiths. Like, how well do you reckon you would have fared in the Soviet Union?
Yeah, I don't know.
Don't think Stalin was a huge fan of the LGBTIQ community.
Yeah, exactly. How well do you think that they go in Russia today?
Yeah, or especially... yeah, exactly. But it's just, you know, if there's tennis courts, like, it does sound like a pretty good timeout.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just because they shot people on them doesn't mean that, you know...
Yeah, yeah. It's a good place to shoot people and have a rally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So, that was pretty funny. Let's move on to another story. So,
yeah, right.
This almost got Q&A clap because I wanted to give it the round of applause that it so richly deserved. Mm. But in the file, the growing file, cabinet, if you will, probably warehouse at this point, of reasons why politicians shouldn't try and be funny.
Mm.
So leadership challenge got a bit crazy in the last few weeks. I think it'd be fair to say that.
Yeah, it's fair.
And it's in absolute fodder for Labour politicians wanting to score one on the Libs to make fun of them. So for any Labour politicians that listen to the show, I know there's a whole lot of them. This is not how you do it, courtesy of Jason Clare.
We always come here. I really just don't know. It's like a kind of torture to have to watch their show. But now, let's get things started. It's time to get things started. Why don't they get things started? On the most sensational, celebrational, inspirational, Muppetational, this is what we call the Muppet Show.
So Nina, you haven't heard that clip yet. What are your immediate reactions to that comedy gold?
What's happening there? Was this a TV show?
Sorry.
Is it a TV show?
So what he's trying to
explain
do...
Explain to me.
Yeah, what he's trying to do is... So that's a Sky News presser. He's just like talking to Sky. And he's quoting the Muppet Show intro.
Yeah.
In the most... Like, put that guy back in. Like, the coding's not finished yet. You can't see it in the audio, but he's just... not there. Like, I think he's just trying to remember the lyrics because apparently he didn't do a very good job of it. I wasn't a big Muppets guy growing up. But yeah, that was not great.
So he's saying the Liberal Party is the Muppets, basically.
Yeah, okay.
We're all invited to the Muppetational Muppet Show. Yeah.
I actually, you know, I'm going to take a different view here. I like it.
Whoa.
I like this stuff.
That? You liked that?
Well, I'd rather listen to that than going...
I'm genuinely... I'm actually impressed.
So I'm the only one who's going like, what the hell?
Because I thought it was like a poetry, you know. Like it's very artistic the way they explain it. We have to start something. This is the Muppet Show, you know?
That's, yeah, I mean,
it's basically explaining what's happening today.
Yeah. Okay, I did not like it. Politicians trying to be funny. My follow-up question was going to be, who did it better, that or YLA Wipeout?
Well, I think it's pretty close.
To me, YLA Wipeout's still the gold standard. That is the strangest video I've ever seen in
the
my
why,
life.
The why, because it was that 30-second pause at the start where you're like...
Yeah.
So I had my theory, which got debunked recently, but my theory was always that, because, yeah, so he says, here's a message out of YLA, and there's just 8 seconds of Craig Emerson staring at a journalist in complete silence while they're waiting for the tunes to come on. And my theory was, like, there's a staffer off to the side just going, like, the second I press the button, I'm an active participant. Yeah. Like, I'm trying to warn him. Yeah. I don't want to, all right, fine, I'll press the damn button. And have Craig Emerson sing YLA Wipeout.
And like that kind of manic look in his face, like of just wild panic as he started singing. But I heard somewhere, I don't know if it's true, that
You told me
they started the tape in the wrong spot. So he's just stood there for
a sign. Surely that's a sign to not do it.
Yeah, he goes back to the office and goes, James, I told you, 10 seconds in you. Anyway. No, look, it's better than...
YLA Wipeout.
Let's tax the banks.
But if you eat one onion, no one will ever make you forget it.
Yeah, exactly.
How did Craig Emerson get away with YLA Wipeout? How come that isn't played every 4 days?
I don't know.
That's a weird one. No, I would prefer Ran to that. That is so bad.
So that is a thing now that I've been doing.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, let's text the banks. Come on.
All right, cool. So I got another one here under the files of politicians trying to be funny.
Yeah, no.
Now, this one was actually defensible. Like, I didn't hate the clip when I saw it, but apparently people did. So, Scott Morrison this morning, I think it... No, well, when did he delete it?
I think it was yesterday.
Yeah, so he deleted it yesterday, but it's in the story this morning. So, Scott Morrison put up a tweet today. He put up a tweet yesterday saying Question Time was on fire today. And he played a video, and it's all the Liberal MPs putting up their hands. And they wanted to have a song that had something about putting up their hands. And they chose... Well, if anyone's ever been to R&B Night at a bar, they've definitely enjoyed themselves a little bit of this. Ow! 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 I could listen to that all day, to be honest. That really gets you in the mood for Friday. I'm going to sprint double speed through the rest of the day now.
You realize you can't change the pace of time.
Well, you know, that's the kind of thought I would have had before Fat Man Scoop came into my life.
That was a real classic on the old Discotheque DFs about 10 years ago.
Still is today, my friend. Head down to Miss Collins tonight. You'll be definitely hearing that and seeing me dance to it. But so he puts up that video and then takes it down because the lyrics, in his words, were not okay. Sorry, there's some stuff at the end of the song which does, like, you know, my thing is... If you're offended by Fat Man Scoop's lyrics, the music is not for you.
Yeah.
It's one of the more mild hip-hop party bangers you'll ever hear.
It's quite optimistic.
Yeah, it's like he's just asking questions.
This is he will get bagged, Morrison, for being like religious.
Yeah.
And now he gets bagged for putting up a song which mentions that actually sometimes people have casual sex.
Yeah, which is, you know, unheard of.
This is why, you know, we can't have nice things.
Yeah, exactly.
This is why nine-year-olds set the national conversation.
Yeah, yeah. I was, like, looking through his Twitter replies, which I shouldn't have done, but it's all... I don't know what I was thinking, but it's all these people going, like, so we're just advocating this kind of behaviour in Parliament now. Like, that was the takeout you had from it?
We could do it.
Seriously. I mean, seriously. This is the part of the thing. When I see the story that Scott Morrison was pressured into, like, the leader of our country was pressured into removing a video because it had Fat Man Scoop's offensive lyrics were not in that video but existed in life, I welcome and accept the asteroid. Like, that's the end for me. Like, if that's where... There's no coming back from that.
James
if you can't
is
play
board.
Fat Man Scoop,
James Bolt is disappointed. Then we're done.
That's the most impressive thing a politician's done for a while.
Thank you. Well, I'm not taking credit for it, but I'm saying, like, someone sees the point.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so
what do you think of that
Jason Clare gets away with the Muppetational thing. Scott Morrison, deletes in disgrace an actual pretty good clip because, their hands are going up in time with Fat Man Scoop's demands. It kind of makes it look like Scott Morrison is singing the song.
It was quite good. Yeah. It was quite good. What did you think of that one? Or did you say it or you couldn't say it?
It's still up there. People copied it across.
Well, actually, I haven't seen it personally.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, you shouldn't just leave it as it is. I mean, it's a good video. It's a really good clip. From what I've heard, I don't think it's like it's. I don't know. I don't think it's insult anyone.
Who would you vote for out of those two, Muppets or Batman Scoop?
It's a
in
hard
a general
question.
Election. It's who a leads hard us into the next few years? Let me just play it again one more time. Just. Now, what are your thoughts?
This one.
This one. Thank you. Okay. Oh. See, it's an absolute vote winner, Scott Morrison. You got to keep it. All right.
Where were we?
We were.
We're in a bit. One of the themes of today's show is outrage and how outraged we are with outrage.
Yeah. Well, because we've been listening to Be Faithful all morning, which is amped up. We're just ready to party. Okay, I got another one here. So, unless you want to go, Pete?
Oh, yeah, no, you go.
Okay, cool. So, Brazilian elections. They're coming up pretty soon. The race is getting pretty bitter. And so bitter that one of the guys running for head office got stabbed at a rally. So, he's a he's a right-wing politician, bit of a populist seems to be. I don't really know a whole lot about Brazilian politics, but he's sort of seen as a far-right candidate.
Is that right? You're not
Brazilian? Well, you know, I know about British soccer, but I don't really know about British politics. So anyway, seen as a far-right candidate, he got stabbed at a rally, and Bloomberg took one particular take, which was a bit questionable. The subheading of the article that Bloomberg wrote about the politician getting stabbed, Bolsonaro is his name. In a better world, the stabbing of a right-wing contender would push voters to focus on their country's deep problems. So it's an interesting take.
Yeah, yeah.
Later in the they start talking about like what effect is this stabbing going to have on the election. And we'll highlight this particular line. In this happy version, a more contrived Bolsonaro, having just skirted death, might even dial back the belligerent law and order shtick that has won him such an enthusiastic following.
Yeah, hopefully the terrorist wins.
Yeah, well, you know, so I think it's just what he was saying that got him stabbed.
Yeah.
Like, what was he wearing on the day? Did he provoke the attack in any way? So I think that's what we need to be asking ourselves here.
Hopefully people see this and think, you know, what if I'm not getting my way, I can stab people and I will.
Yeah, and the other thought is, and then you look at it from the actual words that were said. Him getting stabbed might make him wheel back his law and order approach.
Mm.
Don't think so. I think it might be. I think it might double down. To be honest,
don't think you'll say we need less police.
Yeah, yeah. If we need more police, do I need to show you my abdomen again? So
this is like this is the mainstream press that complains so bitterly about Trump. You know.
Yeah.
And the political climate in the United States.
So yeah, just maybe the stabbing can bring us back to civility.
Yeah.
Is, you know, that's the natural occurrence.
Excellent there. Take from Bloomberg that. So I've got one for you, James.
Go ahead.
Adam Bandt,
mm-hmm.
Greens MP.
Yes.
Correct. Tweeted out, I believe. Tweeted out Facebook. Yep. Some kind of social media post. He wrote, with hot wife.
Sorry. Keep going.
James really likes that song.
You should never let me plug my phone into the machine. I'm going to do that so often.
Yeah, so
our post-show meeting will be on fire, let me tell you that.
That's right. So Adam Bandt, right? So this is what he puts in a social media post. With hot wife at Bangara opening night of Dark Emu. Now, I don't know what that event is, but he was at it with his wife, who he said was hot. Copped a lot of grief from people that probably generally vote for him about objectifying his wife on social media.
How dare he?
Adam Bandt, I don't reckon he's like the worst. You know, like sometimes it's funny to see a confected outrage merchant cop at confected outrage. I don't think he's the worst in that regard. He's probably just...
Yeah, nothing jumps out in my mind of like classic moment.
Yeah, just a kind of run-of-the-mill greenie. Anyway, I'll read a couple of examples. Be more measured in your social media posts. This is not a public statement. It is a private one. It's a... having a firm word with your social media advisor or hire one if you're in danger of misjudged Trumpish outbursts like this. Another one, women in the public eye are sexually objectified enough and you are alienating your progressive support base by contributing to that.
And these aren't random comments. Like, these are getting a lot of likes and shares. Like, that seems to be the mood of his online community.
Yeah, which is bonkers. And there's a funny one. Green voters approved caption, my consensual domestic life partner, who is facially aesthetically satisfactory, is with me.
Still too much for me.
That kind of
thing. Only can appreciate their inner beauty.
So that's pretty funny.
I just love the idea that, like, calling your own wife attractive is a misguided Trump outburst.
What's he meant to say? I'm with my ugly wife.
Yeah, with my hideous... and it seems to have affected her because, like, the next event, she shaved side of her head and wrote cold kills on the side of it. So,
really?
Yeah.
Like, which it doesn't.
Which, unless, like, the other side of her head that didn't get in shot was cold kills, and then on the back is poverty.
Yeah.
That's the only way that one works. I also like the idea. So, back to Catch It Staves one, the one that said, fire your social media manager.
Yeah.
I hope it was Adam Bandt that wrote that, because if the social media manager writes hot wife, Adam Bandt would be like, sorry, mate, what was that?
Hang on.
I'm just reading the post back here.
It's nice to see you on board, mate.
That's a funny one. But, like, that's classic left elite itself kind of stuff. Sorry, that is it for the show this week.
Yeah, that's all.
We good?
Yeah.
I'm in a good place. You in a good place?
I'm in a good place, Nina.
Yeah.
Good place. Good. All right, cool. That's it for the show this week. Thank you to Nigel Farage, Janet Albrechtsen, and Gideon Rosner for the interviews and chats. Really interesting stuff. And thank you guys so much for listening and subscribing. If you are a new listener looking at that Nigel Farage interview, make sure you subscribe. You'll never miss another show. We're available on iTunes, Podbean, Spotify. You can download us through all the apps like Pocket Cast and stuff like that. So make sure you're keeping in touch with us because we'd love to have you on as a listener. And if you are listening on iTunes and you enjoy the show, make sure you're leaving us at 5-star review and telling your friends and family about it. So Nina, if people want to become a member of the IPA, if people want to donate because they're already a member of the IPA, how can they do that?
Just visit the website, ipa.org.au. Oh my God, ipa.org.au.
It's okay, you're only the membership person.
And click on the join button if you want to become a member or reference to someone to as a member. And starting as low as $22 per year, you can become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia. And don't forget to donate as well.
Very cool. And just before I go, make sure you're buying, pre-ordering Lesha's book. Make sure you're coming to that event. If you are in Queensland, go to Connacourt Publishing Online. And if you are in Melbourne, make sure you're going to the ATA Ray Evans Lecture. Ray Evans Lecture on October 12 in Melbourne. So, see you guys next week.
See you later.